third and final case this morning is Robertson v. Department of Correctional Services. Council may approach. Good morning, Ms. Schiffermuller.
Good morning.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court and Council, I'm Joy Schiffermuller, and I'm here on behalf of Anthony Robertson, who brought this action originally pro se in the District Court of Johnson County, Nebraska. As indicated in the pro se complaint that he filed a complaint under the Nebraska Tort Claims Act for injuries that he contends he sustained in May of 2015 when there was a riot at the penitentiary. Obviously, as a pro se complainant, Mr. Robertson's original complaint is not as clear as it should, as one would like, and I agree that probably his appeal that he's filed before this court and the brief that he's supplied that has one single assignment of error is not as clear as one would like. His assignment of error basically is that the court erred in granting the state's motion to dismiss and in dismissing his case. However, I think when you review the record as a whole, you will find that the court did err in making a finding in this case that the motion to dismiss should be granted. And certainly the test for a motion to dismiss under 12b-6 is only if it appears that a plaintiff can prove no set of facts that would entitle him to relief. In this case, the court, in their order, Judge Schreiner found that, basically what happened is the state filed a motion to dismiss, saying that there was ineffective service upon the governor of the state of Nebraska, because in Mr. Robertson's pleadings, he sued the Nebraska Department of Correctional Services and the Office of the Governor of the State of Nebraska. And apparently he issued a summons to the governor and did not at that time issue a summons to the Nebraska Attorney General.
Well, isn't the issue before us whether the court erred in granting the motion to dismiss primarily on the basis that the court said your client failed to allege a breach?
That's
when
correct.
The language of the complaint itself specifically says the department breached its duty by.
That's pretty clear. In paragraph 9 it says defendants breached that duty when it chose to violate the law. And in the later paragraph it says in paragraph 22 that they failed to provide adequate supervision, which I would say alleges a breach. And so we believe that, you know, obviously Judge Schreiner erred in making those findings. I know that the state has spent a substantial time of saying that Mr. Robertson additionally failed to allege compliance with the Political Subdivisions Tort Claims Act. That can be something that can be amended. He was given one opportunity to file a pro se complaint in this case. It's absolutely distinguishable from other cases where persons have tried to amend their complaint over and over, and the court has ultimately decided that they cannot amend. And so I would submit that trial court erred because he clearly did say that there was a breach, and so the judge was in error in saying that the plaintiff does not allege the Department of Corrections breached that duty by failing to create and implement their policies and procedures.
Did he comply with the Tort Claims Act?
It is not alleged in the complaint, but he tells me that he did in fact comply with the Tort Claims Act.
Well, that wouldn't be before us.
So it wouldn't be before you, but I believe the Attorney General would know that he complied with the Tort Claims Act. Maybe they haven't checked. He wants this matter to be reversed and remanded to the district court, and at this time he'll have counsel to represent him, and all of those things can be hashed out where they should be. So I do have 5 minutes left, but I will reserve time for rebuttal and probably don't get all of that time for rebuttal, depending on what the state says. I guess the only other side issue is, I know in one of the briefs the state wrote they alleged that he had not amended his complaint within 6 months, or not, I'm sorry, not gotten service within 6 months on the Attorney General's office, and I would simply point out that in Judge Schreiner's order, he alleges, or he says that the service was ineffective or insufficient at the time of the hearing, but he did serve the office of the Attorney General on April 11th of 2017, and I don't believe there's a cross appeal on that issue. So at this time, unless you have further questions for me at this time,
So the only issue before us is the issue of whether the pleading was effective.
Correct.
To defeat the motion.
Correct.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Smith.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm James D. Smith. I represent the appellees in this matter. The plaintiff's claim is barred by sovereign immunity on strict construction of the State Tort Claims Act or lack of jurisdiction for two reasons. First, the claim is barred by the discretionary function exception to waivers of sovereign immunity under the State Tort Claims Act. Second, the plaintiff did not allege that he complied with the statutory requirement to file his claim with the state's risk manager.
Why didn't the state raise that in the trial court?
No, but it doesn't make a difference because sovereign immunity can be raised on appeal for the first time, and that's specifically Davis v. State and Amend v. Nebraska Public Service Commission, which is
neither of those involved discretionary function, though, correct?
I'm
discretionary
sorry.
Function, that wasn't the basis of either one of those cases that you just mentioned, was it?
No, it wasn't the basis, but the principle would be the same, is simply if it's barred by sovereign immunity, that can be raised on appeal.
Right, but we have to be able to tell that from the face of the complaint, correct?
It would have to be by the basis of the complaint on strict construction of the State Tort Claims Act that the complaint is barred by sovereign immunity.
So if we could tell from the face of the complaint that the discretionary function exception applied, we could grant the motion to dismiss. But can we tell that?
Yes, you can. I would cite four cases, two of which are in my brief. There's the Lingua v. U.S., which is discretionary function for use when you're being sued for design construction materials, and that was to construct a trail. There's Castor v. United States, cited in my brief, which is also talking about prison officials exercising discretion on how to protect, provide for prisoners. That's policy decision. I would also cite, which is not in my brief, but Marish v. State, it's 241 Nebraska 496, that construction design is not actionable against the state since it's a discretionary function. And the other case that I would cite is Reed v. United States. I only have a Westlaw site. It's 2006 Westlaw 2371579. I think those cases would all say at least the nature of the claim that he has made is a discretionary function. And when you look at the claim, what you look at is the gravamen or substance of his cause of action. What he alleged, what he still argues on appeal, is that the state was required by law to use only fire retardant materials to construct inmate units or cells in the Tecumseh prison. That's essentially design construction issues, which are matters of policy. They're not operational.
But if they're required by law, does that not take it out of the realm of discretion?
Not when it's a construction design matter. That's a matter of how the state is going to build a prison, design a prison. His claim also, when he says it's required, frankly, it's totally refuted by the statutes on state fire marshals, which has no such requirement, and those statutes are 81501.01 to 81-531. There's nothing in there about prisons must be constructed only with materials that are fire retardant. That's simply, it's simply not there.
But the issue here is, did he state enough in his complaint to get by a motion to dismiss? And the lower court said that he didn't because he failed to allege a breach.
Well, the lower court didn't even address the issues of sovereign immunity and jurisdiction, which is what I'm raising on appeal.
But let's address what the court did address.
Okay.
Do you disagree?
I don't think the district court's rationale for the dismissal, I don't think is sufficient. My argument is essentially right result, wrong reason, and the reason would be sovereign immunity and no jurisdiction.
So the failure to comply with the Tort Claims Act, you're alleging that's a basis?
Yes.
I know we have cases that say sovereign immunity can be raised for the first time on appeal, but what about failure to comply with the Tort Claims Act? Do we have a case that says you can raise that for the first time on appeal?
Well, are you talking about just the filing requirements?
Right.
Okay. There are two cases, and they're both cited in my brief. There are the Cole v. Isherwood, Weider v. Community College cases, which says that's a procedural requirement, and the state can then assert it, raise an affirmative defense. Now, the affirmative defense argument, I would submit, has been overruled by the Supreme Court's recent cases in Davis and
Ahmed. Well, but Davis is a sovereign immunity case.
Yes.
Whereas the State Tort Claims Act has certain condition precedent requirements that all of our case law has seemed to say is an affirmative defense, and affirmative defenses need to be raised at the trial court level.
But the State Tort Claims Act is the sole provision for the state waiving sovereign immunity, and the Supreme Court has rejected the theory that those exceptions and waivers of sovereign immunity are affirmative defenses. They've now said no, it's no longer affirmative defense, and it can be raised for the first time on appeal. And I would, the last Friday's case, which was Riley v. State Patrol, they said waiver of sovereign immunity is found only where stated by the most express language of the statute or such overwhelming implication from text as would allow no reasonable construction. There are three statutes, thus, which in the Tort Claims Act for waiving sovereign immunity that must be strictly construed and applied. And those are 81-8209, 81-8212, 81-8213. Those statutes, the first one, 81-8209, as far as the Tort Claims Act says, that it is the intent and purpose to bring such uniform procedures for bringing tort claims against the state, and that such procedures by such act shall be used to the exclusion of all others. And then the next two statutes are, all tort claims must be filed with the risk manager, and the next one, no suit shall be permitted under the State Tort Claims Act unless the risk manager or state claims board has made final disposition. The recent cases which said the theory that the state must raise waivers of sovereign immunity in compliance with the Tort Claims Act as affirmative defenses, those cases, I would say, have been rejected, overruled by the Supreme Court's more recent cases in Ahmed and State v. Davis. And I think last week's Riley case, too, where it talks about sovereign immunity. You have to strictly construe the statute. You have to comply with the statutes to get past sovereign immunity. And if you haven't complied, there's no jurisdiction. The state is immune. And so the affirmative defense theory has been rejected by our Supreme Court. As far as the leave to amend argument, one, plaintiff never asked for leave to amend. On appeal, he has made no assignment of error concerning being denied leave to amend. I would cite EDV Lisey Properties, 300 Nebraska 141, where the Supreme Court said, where the argument is, the appellants are arguing, they assign this error, they argue they should have been permitted leave to amend. The appellant's brief makes no claim as to he was denied leave to amend, what he would have alleged if he was granted leave to amend. Rather, he's just making the same argument that his complaint on fire retardant materials was sufficient. It wasn't. I don't know if the court has any further questions.
Any further? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Schiffmiller have for rebuttal? Okay, 4 minutes, 28 seconds.
With respect to the arguments of sovereign immunity and failure to comply with the State Tort Claims Act, I submit that at least there should have been a notice or some appeal by the state in order to raise that question. It certainly was not litigated in the county court or in the district court of Johnson County, Nebraska, and although it was discussed in the brief that was filed by the state, there's no appeal on that basis or cross appeal on that basis. Also, with respect
to... But doesn't Davis allow the state to raise that for the first time on appeal?
Yes, but I think it has to be clearly raised so that a person is given a right to address those issues.
I mean, clearly I don't raised think that where? It's, in the trial court?
I think it should be raised as a motion to dismiss, for example, in the Court of Appeals. I know that they previously raised a motion to dismiss the appeal, but their motion to dismiss the appeal was basically for the reason that the county court was clearly right.
But doesn't Davis say the court doesn't need to raise it at the trial court, that it can be raised for the first time on appeal?
I think that it can be raised for the first time on appeal. I don't believe it has been properly raised in this instance because there's been no motion to dismiss, no cross appeal that the judge should have considered the sovereign immunity question.
Well, how could the trial judge have erred in not addressing it if it's raised for the first time on appeal?
Well, I'm saying that those are two various ways it could come up. They could have raised it in the district court. I do agree that they can raise it for the first time on appeal, but on the appeal of this claim, I don't believe they've properly raised that because they have not filed a motion to dismiss Mr. Robertson's appeal based on the fact that if there was sovereign immunity, that they're for the first time raising it at this level. So I believe that, and furthermore, I would believe that, I would submit that what has occurred in this case is not a discretionary function, as they're trying to say it's a discretionary function. The state has a clear responsibility to provide for a safe and stable place for persons that are in their care to live. There's a lot of case law to indicate that, and that the statutes of the state of Nebraska require them to provide a safe and stable place for persons.
But safe and stable doesn't necessarily equate to fire retardant materials and construction, does it?
That could be true, but I would just alert the court to the fact that that's not the only thing that is brought by Mr. Robertson. He also said that they failed to provide adequate supervision. He was left unsupervised for a number of hours while some of the prisoners killed other prisoners and assaulted people and engaged in a riot. And I believe that there is sufficient evidence that a jury, or not jury, excuse me, it's a tort claim, that the judge, the fact finder, has to make findings in this case. And it needs to be remanded to the court for them to do that. With respect to the fact that Mr. Robertson did not ask leave to amend in the district court clearly at the end of their order said this case is dismissed. so he was not really given the opportunity to amend. I know there's the Dean's case that was brought up in the defendant's brief in this case, where this court found that they would not consider whether or not leave to amend should have been given on plain error in the Dean's, D-E-N-E-S case. But I would submit on this case, there are a lot of differences between this case and the Dean's case that would make it appropriate that this court would consider on plain error whether Mr. Robertson should have been given leave to amend. I mean, he's pro se plaintiff, for goodness sakes, and he was only given one opportunity to file a complaint, and his complaint clearly does say there was a breach of the standard of care. And so we would just ask that it be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. We have it under advisement. We thank you for being here. Counsel is excused, and we are adjourned.